give you Sue D. of California.
Hi, I'm Sue.
Hi.
Very grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups because today I love an alcoholic. And I like to say that because that wasn't always true. And I'm really grateful that this is a big meeting. And usually the Al-Anon meeting is a smaller meeting unless they have Keith share before I do, and then they all want to come and see if he told the truth. And he did. He shared as Keith sees it. I'd forgotten what Oklahoma was about. I remembered this morning when I woke up, you know, why people used to shack up. It's cold here. And boy, he's a cuddler, and I love him for that. But he kept my rear warm last night. No. It is so fun to come back this part of the country. It's like we're home now. And you make us feel at home. And it's neat to see special friends, Chink and Eddie. You know, I love them a lot. We have a lot of friends in this room. And whether we know you or not, I hope we do before we leave, but we identify. I mean, when we come back to the Texas and Oklahoma area to share our experience, strength, and hope, it's like half of our talks cut out because anyplace else you have to share what a honky-tonk is, you know, what a cowboy looks like. And so you just say the word here and everybody laughs. Yesterday when we was coming in on the plane, there were two little boys about 9 years old sitting behind us. And the plane started to land. And we got low enough where you could see the ground, and this one little boy says, "Where's the trees?" And this other little boy said, "I think this is a place that they call like a honky-tonk." And everybody here says, "Yeehaw." And I thought, right on. I took one of the girls I sponsored one time to Texas with me to share because she wanted to see cowboys. But it was a gay conference, and she never did. This guy says, "Honey, I don't think you're going to see none here." So that's how you get back even with newcomers. I sponsor a newcomer. I love newcomers. They light up my life. And Thanksgiving a year ago, this newcomer in my life, she had been in the program 2 or 3 months. And her husband was still drinking. And they'd split up. And it was on Thanksgiving, we'd had our Thursday night meeting. And I went up to her after the meeting, and then I said, "Chris, you know, why don't you go home with me?" "Yeah, no, no, I'm going to be okay." And I said, "Don't go find him." "No, no, I'm not going to do that." Well, I knew she was going to. And she calls about midnight. And she's crying, and she said, "I found him." He was down on Harbor Boulevard where I knew he'd be. And it's cold outside, and he's wet all over himself. He's wet, so I got him in the car. And she said, "Then I could hear your voice in my head. And I knew I'm in Al-Anon, and I can't do that anymore, so I drug him out of my car." And she said, "But I didn't hit his head on the pavement or nothing." And she said, "It was so hard just to go off and leave him laying there on the curb." She said, "I feel so bad." And I said, "Honey, come on over. You know, come on over." And she came over to our house, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just giving her my best stuff. And I finally tell her, you know, bottom line is God takes care of fools and drunks. And she goes, "Oh, well, it's going to be okay." Okay. Yay, you know. So next morning we go to our 11 o'clock Saturday morning meeting on Saturday. And she gets up the podium to share how Al-Anon's working. And how she got him in the car, she found him, got him in the car, drug him out of the car, and how then she went over to her sponsor's house, and she said, in the very end of her talking to me, she said the magic words. She told me that God takes care of frozen drunks. And it's like, you don't know what newcomers are going to hear that's going to help them, yeah? But I love it, you know? We had this older lady in our group, and she was in her 70s, I think, and she was bailing her daughter, who's in her 40s, in and out of jail and all this kind of stuff. And she shared one night, and she lived in an apartment, this big house, and rented the room, and she said, you know, I came 3 months ago because my landlord is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he kept wanting me to go to Al-Anon. And she said, I'm so grateful to him. And she said, Al-Anon works. She said, I haven't bailed my daughter out of jail for 3 months, and him and I have sex once a month. Al-Anon works. But I heard a joke the other day that is just what I think is the answer to alcoholism for Al-Anons. I think we should all try it. And I heard that Bubba and Earl were going down the road in their pickup, and they were drinking Budweiser's. And they saw a sobriety checkpoint up front. And Bubba says, Earl, hurry up and down that bud. Peel the label off, stick it on your forehead, and toss that bottle out in the bar ditch. And so Bubba did the same thing. And they get up the sobriety checkpoint, and the highway patrolman looks at him, and he said, whoa, you boys been drinking today. And Bubba said, oh, no, sir. He said, well, what are you doing with those Budweiser labels on your forehead? He said, oh, man, we're on the patch. I think all Al-Anons that have a practicing drunk stick that label on their forehead. Oh, God is good. Yeah, I just love being here. I want to thank you for the baskets. They're the neatest baskets we've ever gotten. They're big. Good. And I just love being home. I love being here. I was raised up in the panhandle, well, all over western Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma panhandle. My dad was, he worked in the oil fields, and I was raised in the oil fields, and I was called oil field trash all the time growing up. And we lived in a trailer house, and that trailer house would follow the rigs, and everywhere the rig went, we did too. There was times I'd go to 5, 6, 7 schools in 1 year. Never felt like I belonged anywhere. And I've learned a lot of things in this program about how people end up in this program. And I had a lot of characteristics before I ever met an alcoholic. Because I used to wonder, what's a lady like me doing in a place like this? Because I'd hear ladies in Al-Anon mention that they'd been married to an alcoholic before and were on their second or third husband and they're alcoholics too. And I was raised in an alcoholic home and I wasn't. And I'd think, how did I get here? And always had a lot of smug and arrogance, I'll show you. And I am so grateful for the steps of this program because I got to find out that those characteristics of not feeling like I belonged anywhere, feeling like a nobody and like I didn't count and all that kind of stuff, because I never was any place long enough to really feel like I fit in or get acquainted. And my folks finally moved to Perryton, Texas and moved into a house. And I loved it up there. And I wanted to be a hometown girl. I wanted to be something that I could never be. Yeah, and so I never felt like I fit in that perspective, you know. And when I was a sophomore in high school, my dad passed away with cancer. My older sister had run off and got married, and that left my mother and younger brother and I at home. And after a period of time, my mom started dating, and I hated her for that. You know, she's been disloyal to my father. And I started rebelling, and I started looking for love in all the wrong places. And I ended up in San Antonio in an unwed mother's home. And I stayed there for a period of time, and I gave a child up for adoption. And I'm so grateful that I did that, because you understand, at that age, I wasn't ready, willing, or able to be a parent. And I heard a lady say something to me in there, a counselor, that I never heard again until I found you. And she said to me, God uses people to help other people. And God used you as an instrument to help some people have a child they can't have one. And so you've been an instrument of your God. And I accepted that, and I went back home in kids I used to run with were boring and mundane. And they were boring, real boring. And so I started going to those honky-tonks with my mom and her friends, and God, I loved it. I walked in, and it was loud and rowdy, and people were cussing and yelling and smoking and drinking and dancing. It's like, yeah, I am here. I mean, I had found home. I loved it. And a fight broke out, and I've been watching this cowboy move the room, and he was pretty cute. And he started this fight, and I thought it took a lot of courage to do that. And immediate attraction there. And he came running past me and ran in the woman's restroom and said, honey, let me know when the fight's over. And so like a good pre-Alamon, I've been given direction, and so I stood on duty. And pretty soon I opened the door and I said, okay, cowboy, you can come out now. And he came out and he asked me for the last dance. I don't have to explain the last dance to you. You know what the last dance is. You rub up against each other, get ready to go home. Yeah, we did it. And, and this was a fast dance. And boy, it kept getting faster and faster and faster. And we never missed a lick. And God, I loved it. And I look back on that. He got me downtown right now. He got me in the fast lane. He did for me what nothing else had ever done for me, and I loved it. And we get home, and the next day he calls me and asks me for a date. My mom said, no, you're not going with him. He's older than you. He's been married before, and he's in trouble all the time. And I said, I don't care. And so he came, he said he'd pick me up around 7 or so, and so the doorbell rang, and I go to the doorbell, and there's, answer the door, and there's Keith. And I said, great, you know, and I get my purse and get outside, and I go, wait a minute, my dates pick me up in cars. There wasn't anything out there. He said, well, you don't understand. He said, I've told my car and my driver's license has been taken away from me forever. I said, no problem. I've never had a ticket. And so we got in my car, and we started. I took him to the drive-in movie. I knew what to do at the drive-in movie. And you sit there and kiss and smooch and steam up the windows. And we sat at that movie, and we watched the movie. And I start thinking, whoa, what's wrong with me? We have a pamphlet in Alamon that talks about that. Aren't I pretty enough? Aren't I smart enough? You know, what's wrong with me? And then it dawned on me, he had a six-pack of beer sitting between his legs that he was more interested in than me. And that set up that competition. I wanted to be number one in that man's life more than I wanted anything. And I'm going to prove to him that I'm there. And, boy, I tried that a lot. And we started dating. And we'd go up to Liberal, Kansas, across the Oklahoma Panhandle, and we'd go to those honky-tonks up there. And God, I loved it. I just loved it. And we went up there one time. He wasn't paying any attention to me. We was at the Shangri-La. And God, it was a great Quonset building. And and he wasn't paying enough attention to me. Now, I know how to make a man pay attention to me. You start flirting with somebody else. And when they notice him paying attention to you, then he'll pay attention to me. And I didn't know alcoholics worked in opposites. He didn't start paying attention to me. He got mad at me. And so we got in that fight of we're leaving and who's going to drive home. And he won, and we went out and got in the car, and we start out from Liberal going across the Oklahoma Panhandle. And they have radar set up. And we're going 100 miles an hour. And Keith said, oh, my gosh, if they catch us now, I'll never see the sun again. And I said, no problem. I've never had a ticket. So we switched places in that car going 100 miles an hour. There's nothing wrong with me yet. And we get down to the other end of the state line and they got a roadblock set up for us. And so we stop and the policeman comes up the window and said, we don't know how you got under the wheel of this car, but we've checked it out and this car's been reported stolen. And he smarted off the cops and somebody jerked him out of the car and handcuffed him, put him in the sheriff's car, told me to follow him 40 miles to Beaver, Oklahoma so they could arrest me, so I did. And and we was there for a while and they were booking us and fingerprinting us and told us we could have one phone call. And Keith said, I want to speak to the district attorney. And I go, whoa, this man goes straight to the top. I am so impressed, and I'm being fingerprinted, and I'm impressed, yeah. And pretty soon this real good-looking man walks in. He had mature gray hair, and he had on a coat with a fur collar turned up. He was really cool. I was immediately attracted to him, and I know today it's because he's an alcoholic, too. Yeah. And I love alcoholics. Alcoholics are my entertainment. I just listened to Joe's show this morning. It was better than going to a movie. You know, it's just, they are exciting. That is what attracts me to that personality. And, you know, I'm grateful as all get out that my father-in-law is an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, but I hated him because Keith was just like him, I thought. I blamed everybody or anything. He had bad friends, Oily and Goose. I hated them, you know. Everybody was a bad influence on him. And he wouldn't let me pick his friends. And I'd go through the deal, if you can't lick them, join them, you know. And did all that stuff. And he'd come over to my house on Wednesday nights. And we were supposed to watch TV on Wednesday nights. And he was supposed to dote over me. And he'd sit there and he'd fall asleep. What I know today is that he passed out. And it's like that smug and arrogance would come up in me, and you don't treat me like that when you're here with me. You pay attention to me, and by God, I'm going to get even. The sweet taste of revenge. God, I loved it. And Keith had long hair, and he had a long, straggly beard, and I thought, damn him. He's done this to me more than once, and he'll never do it again. So I shaved half his head and half his face off. He went around like that for 2 weeks. Never said one word to me about that. And my mom would say, I wonder when he's going to say something to you about that. Yeah. Never did. We'd drag Main Street and we'd go this way. And then he'd turn around and he says, everybody says I'm two-faced anyway, you know. And I'd giggle. I just thought he was so cute, you know, and doing those kind of things. So it's like I couldn't do anything to one-up him, you know, couldn't do anything. And he was going to, you know, he got a draft notice, and he was going to get drafted. And so we ran off to Amarillo to get married. And I was pregnant. And, you know, the neat part about that is that, you know, when I'd been pregnant before, I'd gotten bought off with that deal. I got my business college paid for and the whole deal so that kid didn't have to marry me. And with my smug and arrogance, you know, I got the deal. And when I told Keith that I was pregnant, he said, I'm going to do the right thing. And that's the thing I love about the alcoholic personality, is that you do know right from wrong. You do have feelings. You see, I went through this disease of alcoholism with Keith for years thinking he had no feelings. And it's a program of Al-Anon that's taken out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the same steps that taught me how to work those steps and a sponsorship, strong sponsorship, that taught me how to write and take my inventory. And this Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me about the alcoholic personality. And I'm so grateful for that because, you see, I love alcoholics today. I love my husband. And I know that he hurt as bad as I hurt. Always wanted to get even with him because he never hurt as much as I hurt. And I know today that he used to drink because he didn't know how to handle those feelings and what to do with them. And the program of Al-Anon has given me compassion compassion for a disease, to understand that alcoholics aren't mean and ugly. They're scared to death. And getting caught up in that disease, I'm the kind of Al-Anon that believes that I got it. I think it's through association. And I believe it's a family disease. My literature tells me that all the time. And so all those things that were going on in our life, he did what was right. And I told him, I said, no man's ever going to say to me, I got to marry you. I said, because I know what to do. Now, and we got married. We ran off to Amarillo and we got married. Keith never did throw that in my face. He never did. He was a gentleman with that from the very beginning. Many times, I never remembered that until I got to Al-Anon and was able to look at the truth. This program teaches us to look at the truth. And I'm grateful for those kind of teachings in my life. That didn't make everything fine, and it didn't make everything wonderful. After he took his draft physical, he got rejected. Uncle Sam didn't want him, so I got to keep him. And we moved to Stillwater, and Keith enrolled in school one more time. And Keith'd been in school many, many years, but he never got a degree, and I knew that I had what it took to make him stay put, because that's all he needed to do, is just stay somewhere long enough that he could finish. And so we got to Stillwater, and shortly after that, I had our daughter, Simone. And I remember when they handed her to me, thinking, thank God she's a girl. Because, you see, he was a drunk, his dad was a drunk, and his granddad was a town drunk. I knew if we had a boy, he'd carry on the family tradition. I didn't know that alcoholism doesn't care what sex, color, race, or creed you are. It takes you to the gates of insanity and hell, and you don't even have to drink booze to get there. Alcoholism is ugly. It's a family disease. It's a family illness. And it runs downhill. It came from the alcoholic, and it came on me, and I took it out on our daughter. We stayed there in Stillwater for 4 years so he could get a 2-year degree, and I took all the credit for it. Because, you see, I needed that validation. I needed to be somebody. Because the disease of alcoholism had started telling me that I'm nobody, that I'm dumb and stupid and that I don't count. And I am constantly trying to prove to that I am somebody, that I do know something. And I'd lose all those kind of fights that we'd have, and he'd tell me things, and, you know, I'd go to the filling station to get gas and come right back, and I'd be called ugly names. And I'd think, what happened? I didn't do nothing to get called that. All I did was get gas. What's wrong with that? I didn't even talk to anybody while I was there. And alcoholism was constantly telling me those things. And I'd think, maybe something. Maybe I did do something, you know. And then he'd tell me, you know, I'd say, I feel this way. No, you don't. This is the way you feel. And if you feel that way, you aren't worth anything, and blah, 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 blah. And alcoholism talks like that. Alcoholism uses people to get to other people. And it teaches us, alcoholism teaches us to put others down. Because if we can get somebody down lower than us, then we're cut above. And alcoholism does that. It's so negative. And that was happening in our home. And it wasn't hard for Keith to pick a fight with me. I was the mouth. You know, and I wasn't afraid. I wasn't afraid. God, I'm so grateful for inventory work, because I remember when I did my inventory, my first exam, and I did the four-column method that it used in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where my sponsor got it from. And that's what she taught me to do. And I couldn't remember when I did that inventory, you know, what was my part? Because my first resentment was Keith, and it was the violence. And how did it make me feel like a nobody, like I didn't count, that I was nothing. And I had to get down on my knees and pray to my God to put the words in the pencil that I needed to see on that paper so I could look at me. What part did I have to play in that? Because, you see, I believe that there are no volunteer victims in here. They are just volunteers. Nobody held a gun to my head and said, you've got to marry that man. I picked him out. And when I did that inventory and I got up off of my knees and I started writing this, like, oh my gosh, Jill mentioned earlier, like a video going past me. And I could see us fighting. And I could see me standing in front of Keith and he'd say, Sue, get away from me. Get out of my face. And I'd take one step closer. And I'd hear him say to me, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. And I would take one step closer. And the knockdown, drag-out fight would be on. Because by gosh, I'll show you. And Keith being a cowboy, he played with guns all the time and he always had a gun out. It scared the living tar out of me. I hated that gun. It shot things that I didn't want to get shot. And that would make me even more angry. And so it's like all that arrogance came up in me and I'll show you. And I picked up my butcher knife and I started fighting back with that butcher knife. And wow, the war was on. And I remember many times he'd stand, put his gun right on the end of my nose, and he'd say, if you don't shut up, I'm going to shoot you. And I'd take my knife and stick it right in his stomach, and I'd say, you go first. And he'd say, what do you mean, you go first? He said, if I shoot you, you're dead. And I said, yeah, but when the bullet knocks me backwards, the momentum will make the knife go forwards and we'll both die at the same time. So go for it, dude. And he'd look at me and he'd say, you're crazy. And I was. I found out in that inventory because I needed to know why was I so angry, and I found out it was fear. But what scared me more than anything when I first got to this program was that my number one fear was that I had none. I had none. When we'd go to those honky-tonks or places that we'd never been before, we'd drive up and Keith said, go in there and see what's happening. If I came out without a black eye, we danced. If I came out beat up, we went someplace else. I was never afraid to walk in anywhere. We were out at the FW building one night and we was dancing and having a lot of fun and this gal came up and she started flirting with Keith. Now, you don't fool around with my man. And I told her, I gave her a chance. And she just kept on and kept on and by God, I got a hold of her and I threw her through that plate glass window. And the ambulance came and they took her to the hospital and nobody fooled with him again. About 6 weeks later, she came back to that dance. And she came up to me and her face was all scarred up. She said, look there. They had to take skin off of my hip to fix my face of what you did to me. And I don't have a clue. I don't even remember what her name was before that. But after that, her name was Buttface. There was no compassion whatever. Now, you fool with me and mine and you're in trouble. And whatever the consequences are is your fault. You know, and that's like, Keith and I were in the program about 6 years and he was talking to some guys one time about, we'd been at a party with my boss had a Christmas party. And we were getting ready to leave and I kept butting in and talking when he was talking to my boss and he just hauled off and slapped me. Right in front of my boss. And Keith looked at me and he said, he made amends. He said, did I ever make amends to you for that? And I said, no. He said, well, I need to make amends to you for that. But why did yours just go off? He said, it didn't matter where we were. You just would go off. He said, I never understood that. And I said, it wasn't my fault. If you hadn't been drinking like that, I wouldn't have had to do half of the stuff that I did. You know? And, you know, after Keith got out of school, he came home and he said he wanted to move to California. And I said, no, no way. Ain't going to California. It's too wild and crazy out there. We'll never raise children in California. And he said, babe, you don't understand. He said, you've been going to these honky-tonks and you've been drinking out of paper sacks. And he said, you go out there and you can order cocktails in restaurants and a lady like you belongs out there. And I'm going, yeah. And so he hurried up and built this big box and put it on wheels and sprayed it bright blue and hooked it on the back of our station wagon, and we headed for California. And like he said last night, we looked like the grapes of wrath, boy. It was unreal. And took us 30 days to get out there. The part of that story that is so important that I have to remember, that I have to remember for me, is that I can remember, because he'd gotten that prescription filled in the baggie in that drugstore at midnight, that there were things he took that made him just stay down. And I can remember waking up in the morning and looking at him to see how I was supposed to feel. And I remember looking at him and so I could tell Simone, our daughter, how she was supposed to act that day. Because, you see, you don't want to upset Daddy. Because if you upset Daddy, he starts drinking and then it gets really bad. And so we don't want to upset Daddy. I started living in someone else's shadow. Because alcoholism was alive and well. I am so grateful today that we are individuals in our home, in our family, and that we don't have to rely on each other in order for us to feel good or feel bad. We have choices today. We aren't two sick people that are hooked on to each other. We are two individuals trying to get healthy enough to walk around down this road of life hand in hand. That's what the 12 steps do for us in here, and the traditions. I'm a very strong believer that the traditions apply in the home. Because early on I was told if I don't take these steps for myself and work these traditions in my home, then I didn't have a program to stand on. Because you see, our family is a group. And those traditions apply for the group. We took many group consciences in our home in the very beginning. After we got to California, it was Keith wasn't ever going to work in the oil fields again. He went out there and started working for an oil company. And that took him off a lot. And I remember standing and looking for him out the window, waiting. And he'd never come home. I can remember standing in my house vacuuming. And I'd be mumbling, just mumbling. When he gets home, I'm going to say this. And when he says that back, then I'll say this. And I was writing the whole script of the whole deal. And Simone would look at me and she'd say, Mommy, who are you talking to? And I'd knock her out of the way. And I'd say, get away from me. I'm busy. Because, you see, alcoholism was taking the ability away from me to be a parent. I was losing the ability of being a good mother. And I'd tell Simone to do things like clean up her bedroom. And she'd clean up the bedroom the best of her ability. And it had to be spotless. Everything had to be in its place. And everything had to be out of the way and off the floor. And I'd say, did you get your bedroom cleaned up? Yeah, I did, Mommy. I'd say, let me see. And I'd go in there and I'd raise up the bedspread. And she'd stuff all of that stuff under her bed. And by God, I'm not stupid. Because alcoholism always told me I was stupid. And she's a kid, and I'm not going to be more stupid than her. She's not going to pull things like that on me. I'm the parent, don't you understand? And I'd take trash bags in her room, and I'd haul everything out from under her bed, her toes, her clothes and her toys and everything. Put them in that trash bag and put it out in the trash. And I remember her standing there and crying and saying, Mommy, don't throw my stuff away. I say, you don't deserve it. You don't care. We give you things and you don't care. You don't appreciate nothing. You see, that's what I was hearing. That's what I was hearing. So I had to give it away somewhere. And it went out of my daughter. And then Keith would come home and I'd say, where have you been? He'd say, get out of my face. And it'd be on again. And that's alcoholism. He came home one night and he said, babe, you want to go out to dinner? And I said, oh, bye. Yeah, because you see, that's why I'd moved out there anyway. Because I wanted to be a classy lady. So we hurried up and we got dressed and we were going to go out to dinner and we were going to be somebody. We get all dressed up and get in the car and we drive up in front of this brick building and God, it's so pretty. It has cocktails on neon signs in front of it. It doesn't have rosies painted on the window or Shangri-La on a board above the door. It's a nice place, and classy people are going in there, and God, I want to be like that. And so we get in there, and you know, they come over, and they said, would you like a cocktail? And I said, you bet. We didn't leave Simone out at all. We ordered her a Shirley Temple, and they came over with those drinks, and they said, our drink's down in front of us. And Keith picked up his drink, and he said, let's toast to the good life. And all three of us are sitting there toasting to the good life. And we drink our cocktails. Simone drinks her Shirley Temple. And God, we're wonderful. Except that I notice, you know, see, I thought that if you ordered drinks like that in a place like that, you couldn't get drunk because somebody else was mixing them. But I noticed that he had drank 10 to my one already. I knew exactly how many he had drank. When I looked around and those people in there, they were drinking out of these long-stemmed crystal glasses, and God, they were beautiful. I'd never had anything like that being oil field trash. God, I wanted to be that way. And they were swishing this stuff, and they were sniffing it. God, they were classy people, and I didn't know why they were doing stuff like that for, but I wanted to be like that. And so the waiter came over and asked us if we wanted to order, and so we gave him our order. He said, would you like wine with your dinner? And I said, you bet. And he came over, and he set those crystal glasses down in front of us, and it's like, oh, wow, I'm going to be somebody. Because, you see, I was always sharing my insides with your outsides. If I could just feel the way you looked, I'd be okay. Because my insides were always telling me I was nobody. And those crystal glasses were sitting there, and it's like, oh, I got all the props and everything. I can be a lady in here. And he sets Keith down, and he pours just a little bit in it and asks Keith if it's okay. And I looked at him, and I said, what do you mean, is it okay? He drank stuff in Oklahoma that had things floating in it. Pour mine. And the guy looked at me and said, oh, okay. Now, and I sat there in my smug and arrogance, and I swish it, and I sniff it. And God, I'm wonderful. I am somebody, finally. Until I look across the table at Keith, and he's sitting there drinking out of the carafe. And I just scream at him, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm drinking. What's it look like I'm doing? And I say, not like that. And I holler at the waiter, bring our food over here. You get over here with our food. And the guy walked over there and looked at me. I'll never want to forget it. He looked at me and he said, I'm sorry, you aren't eating here. And I said, and why not? He said, because you don't know how to act. Whoa. And we could never go back. He's escorting us out and he's talking to everybody in sign language. And we get home, and I'm right in his face. Don't you ever treat us like that again. He said, get out of my face, and I took one more step. He said, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you, and I took one more step, and the knockdown, drag-out fight was on. And he got me down on the bed, and he had his hands around my throat, and he was choking the living tar out of me. And I thought, my God, if he doesn't let go of me, I'm going to die. I'm going to die right here on this bed. And I looked up at him, and he was looking down at me with all the intensity he had, and it dawned on me. He's not thinking about nothing but me. I have 100% of his attention. And I loved it. I loved it. And that became a regular routine in our home on a daily basis. We did that one day at a time for 13 years because I loved the negative attention. It was mine. It was all mine. That's a disease of alcoholism. We'd have those fights and the neighbors would call the cops or Simone would call the cops or I'd call the cops when he'd get on Simone and they were at our house all the time. And they'd take him down and they'd arrest him and I'd have to go down there next morning. Because you see, that night I had to sleep. That's the only time I'd get any sleep. It's when he was locked up. And I'd go down the next morning and I'd write a hot check and bail him out. And then I'd call his dad and I'd say, I just wrote a hot check to get Keith out of jail and you got to send me the money to cover it because he's just like you. Blaming everybody else for what we did. You see, it wasn't my fault I had to write those hot checks because he always had money out of the bank and everywhere. And I didn't know which bank account had the most money in it. And I was writing hot checks all over town. I hated that. I hated that. I remember going down there one time and thinking, I'm going to see him through that window before I bail him out this time. I am going to talk to him, and he will know where he's at, as if he had to wait in jail for me to tell him that he was in jail. And I remember standing there in all my smug and arrogance, and there was a bunch of other people in there. And I'm looking down on them. Oh, my God, what am I doing here in a place like this? You know, these people are beneath me with all my arrogance intact. And I had to find you to find out that I was seeking Lord companionship too. Just like Joe said this morning, I was there because everybody else, just like everybody else, had the moron in there. Because I thought Keith wasn't smart enough to stay out. I didn't think he had a brain, and I didn't think he felt. God. And we think, the non-alcoholic thinks that when we find this program that we don't owe any amends. Al-Anons don't have steps. We have tons of gratitude that we owe to Alcoholics Anonymous for giving us the same steps that you work. We work the same steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only difference is in the last step. It says we carry the message to others, which means the family, friends, and loved ones of the alcoholics. We think that we are a cut above. And we go nuts on you and on the rest of the family without one drop to drink. You know, when Keith first got sober, he was a secretary down at the Milano Club. Met a guy a while ago that was from that. He used to go to that Anaheim Milano Club. And I said, are you one of the guys that I used to fight with? Because we'd go down there to that Milano Club. And Keith was the secretary. And so Simone and I was the Sunday morning meeting. We'd get all dressed up because it was like that was our church. Because that was the closest we'd gotten to God in years. And we'd get dressed up, and Simone and I would go stand behind that coffee bar, and we would pour coffee for the alcoholics on Sunday morning. Thank God for them letting us do that. But from time to time, there'd be some smart aleck come up and say, what are you doing back there? You're an Al-Anon. You can't pour coffee in an AA meeting. And I'd say, I happen to be sicker than you. And they'd go, what? I'd say, you had to drink to do all the stuff you did. I did it stone sober. And I truly do believe today that the families of get sicker than the alcoholics. Because we know what we're doing and we can't stop doing it. And we're doing it sober. And we had to do all of those things. And, you know, Keith got taken to court and I was going to get a divorce. And the lawyer said, if you really love him, why don't you take him to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I don't know what that is. He said, it's a place where people go to stop drinking. And it's like, oh, wow, I got an answer. I got an answer. And so I went home that night, and I told Keith that the lawyer told me that if I truly love you, I should take you to Alcoholics Anonymous. He looked at me with all the honesty he had, and he said, babe, I thought it would come to this, so I called a man in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I didn't know he was on a court card. I took it all personal. I wanted to think that he was doing it because he loved me. I am so grateful today that my husband is sober for himself. Because I know that an alcoholic can't sober up for anybody but themselves or it won't work. Because we've tried it many times in our home. And he told me he called that man in AA and that he told him where there was a meeting. I said, great, we'll go there. And he said, well, we'll see. So I hurried up and I fixed dinner and we ate dinner and he went and laid on the couch and Simone and I hurried up and did the dishes and I watched that clock. And he had told me the meeting started at 8:30 and at 8 o'clock I went and got my butcher knife. And I went over at that sofa and I jabbed him and I said, get up. And he said, what for? And I said, we're going to go to that AA meeting. He said, I don't think so. And I jabbed him again. And so he got up and he got in the car with me and he told me where to go to take him to that AA meeting. We got there at that meeting and I said, okay, what time's this meeting over? He said, 10 o'clock. I said, I'll tell you something, dude. You come out of that door before 10 o'clock, I'll get you. Now, when I got Al-Anon, you told me that I couldn't keep a drunk sober, but I did for 4 months sitting in that parking lot every Monday night with my butcher knife. And when I thought he had it down pat, I let him go by himself, and he got struck drunk immediately. And I had a big resentment toward Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he'd go nuts and stuff, he'd leave, and everything, I'd call our folks and report him to our folks back in Beaver and Perryton. I got a hold of his stepmother one time, and she said, honey, you are so young. If you can't leave this man, why don't you go to Al-Anon? And I said, what is that? She said, that's the place where people go that love alcoholics, and they can help. She said, call information. And I said, okay. So I hung up, and I dialed information. I got their number, and I called them really quick. They answered the phone, and I said, yeah, I need some help. I need somebody to help me. This lady said, okay, let me have your phone number and we'll have someone call you. And this lady called me and she said, I'm a member of Al-Anon. And I said, thank God. How do you make them stop drinking? She said, oh, honey, we don't do that, but we can help you. I said, no, no, you don't understand. If you'll quit drinking, I'll be fine. And she said, why don't you take down my number? There might be a day when you need us. And so then instead of calling our folks and reporting to our folks, I'll call this Al-Anon lady, and I'd say, he's doing it again, you know. How do you make him stop? And she'd say, honey, please come and go to a meeting with me. And I'd say, no, no. If he'll quit drinking, I'll be fine. I don't need help. And I was on the phone talking to her one day, and he walked in. It scared me to death, and I slammed that phone down, and he goes, who was that? I said, it was Al-Anon. And if you don't stop drinking, I'm going to call him again. And he quit for about 2 hours. So I didn't have to make that phone call again. No. But what I know that is important for me today, important for me, and I was sharing with a man in here this morning, that his wife doesn't want, he's got 2 years sober and his wife doesn't want to go down on. Keith and I would not be together today if it wasn't for the program of Al-Anon. Because the man that came to 12-step Keith in that last drunk told me that Keith couldn't stay sober if I didn't find a new way of life in Al-Anon. That he'd have to leave to maintain his sobriety or else he'd end up drunk again. And I believe that's true. A sober alcoholic can't stay sober in the environment they used to drink in. And so I am so grateful that I hit a bottom. And I believe that every non-alcoholic has to hit a bottom just like every alcoholic. And I don't call them Al-Anons. I don't believe that there's an Al-Anon unless you go to Al-Anon meetings, you have a sponsor, you work the steps, and you do all the stuff. Al-Anons work a program. Al-Anon, it doesn't make me an Al-Anon to be married to a drunk. There are certain requirements in order for you to be called a member of Al-Anon family group. And I had to hit that bottom. And I think every one of us does. And I remember that last drunk in our home, and Keith had Simone over in the corner, and he was doing all the things to her that he had always done. And it's like I saw it for the first time. And a feeling came over me, and I didn't grab my knife, and I didn't scream and holler and cuss at him. I stood there, and very calmly I looked at him, and I said, Keith, I don't love you anymore. But I don't hate you either. And if you got to become a Skid Row bum, because that's what I thought alcoholics did, then that's what you got to do. But Simone and I ain't going any further with you. And we got a few things together, and we walked out of that house for the very last time with nothing. Nothing but a couple of changes of clothes. And when I got here, you told me I had to give it all up. All up. Everything. In order to have it all. And you've never lied to me. Because that day I gave it all up. Next 4 days, I don't remember what happened. But I remember Simone wanting to go back home to get some things for school. And she begged me to take her back home. And so I said, okay. And we went back to that house, and it was dark, and we were afraid to go in because there were times that Keith shot so many things. He was always going to commit suicide. So we didn't know if we'd find him dead or alive. He used to have an old sawed-off shotgun, double barrel, that kind that you jack back, and he kept it under the recliner. And when he wasn't getting drunk, he'd sit in that recliner and get that shotgun out and drink Red Mountain wine. I put that shotgun in his mouth and click the trigger. I got so tired of that. I died many times watching that man do that. And one day I thought, if he comes in and does that one more time, and I put a shell in that gun. And he came home, just like he always did, got his jug of wine out because he wasn't drinking. And he pulled out that old shotgun. And he put it in his mouth, and he jacked it back, and he goes, oh, my God, and he clicks the trigger, and he killed our air conditioner. Pulled it off. We had a big fight because he killed our air conditioner. So he was always going to commit suicide. So we didn't know what we were going to find in that house. There was a time Simone brought a little old shaggy dog home, and she sat in our living room loving on it. And all of a sudden, he just jumped straight up out of his chair. And he grabbed his .45 off the end table there. And he shot that dog. And he screamed, you're not going to love anything more than you love me. Nobody cried in that home that day. Because if you cry or show any emotions, you might be next. So those are the kind of things we were thinking about, or I was thinking about as we walked up to that house. What are we going to find next? And we went in there and we looked around and we finally found Keith face down on the bedroom floor and we thought he was dead, so we kicked him. And he turned over and he looked at me and he said, Sue, please help. And I know that this is when God came into my life. God gave me the power and the courage to say one word to that man that I could never say to him before in my life. And it's so powerful. No. No, I can't help you. If you want help, you help yourself. I remembered standing there pouring out booze, filling bottles up with water, taking him to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew there was nothing I could do to help that man. For the first time in my life, I was powerless. And when I became powerless, he got up off of that floor and he went and made some phone calls for himself, thank God. And that's when little Jack came over to our house. The doorbell rang and I went to the door and there's a little gray-headed, shriveled-up man standing there. And I'm thinking, Jesus, why don't they take the big ones for these trips? And little Jack came in and he's a wonderful little man. We love him. He's in our life today. And he's such a sweetheart. And he took Keith to a detox and asked me to go with him. And then he took me back home and sat in the driveway with and told me about Al-Anon. And he did the classic 12-step that they talk about in this book. He carried the message to the families of. And he said, let's go in the house. Simone's worried about her daddy. And he went in there and told Simone if she loved her daddy, she'd go to a program called Alateen. since Mom and I started going about one meeting a week. And as Keith said last night, we went when he was getting ready to get out of that detox, we went in there for a family meeting, and the counselor was there. And asked the mom how she felt about her dad, and he said, she said she hated his guts, and that was good news to me. Because I'd tried to tell him that many times, and he was finally hearing it sober. And then she asked the mom how she felt about her mother, and she said, I hate her guts. And I don't ever want to forget how I felt when I heard that child say that. You see, I hadn't saved that child from the disease of alcoholism at all. I had participated. And I knew I needed as much help as the alcoholic did. And I started going to Al-Anon meetings then for myself. And I remember walking back into that Al-Anon meeting and seeing our big book laying on the table. And at that time, Al-Anon's big book cover said, Living with an Alcoholic, and I knew you knew. And there was a lady in there that answered all my questions before I even asked. And everybody was getting something that they called a sponsor. And I wanted whatever it was, because I wanted this thing. I wanted something. I wanted help. I wanted to feel better. And you told me that feeling comfortable was an inside feeling, not something when you sit down in the chair that it fit. That it was an inside feeling. And I wanted that comfortable. Because you looked good. You were smiling. You were happy. And you were talking to each other. And you talked to each other about your husbands, and you liked them. And I didn't understand that. And people were coming up and they were hugging me. And, oh, God, it made my skin crawl. Don't touch me. And I went over to my sponsor and I said, make them quit doing that. And she said, no, that's part of the program. And I said, why? Why do they have to do that? And she said, because they want you to keep coming back. And I said, then why in the heck don't they just say that? And she said, I want to tell you something very important. She said, when they put their arms around you, and you put your arms around them, God follows. And you're both embraced in the fellowship of this program, and you're safe. I went, wow. She said, in fact, you're going to collect 8 hugs at every meeting you go to. I said, I don't mind. She said, I don't care. Yeah? And so I started doing that. I started doing that. She'd tell me, turn it over. And I'd say, what? Turn it over. Tell me. And she said, it's just let go, release. And she was saying all these words that I'd never heard of before. So I started playing forget. Okay, God, if you're there, I'm just going to forget for about 20 minutes. And if you don't do something with it by then, you don't get to do it anymore. And I don't remember the last time I timed God. Things started getting better in our home. And I went out to my sponsor one night and I said, you know what? I said, I feel good in here now. And I feel good getting these hugs, but I don't feel this way at home. And she said, if you aren't taking this program home, you don't have one. She said, in fact, tonight you're going to go home and hug Keith. I said, I don't want it. She said, I don't care. And so she came up and she said, I want you to call me tomorrow and tell me you've done that. Okay. So I go home and I'm praying. You know, God grant me serenity, blah, 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 blah. And Keith comes home and he starts walking down the hall toward me and I'm going, oh, jeez. And he gets up beside me and I put my arm around him and I hug him. He goes, what's that for? I said, just for the hell of it. They told me to do it. Don't ask me why. And that's how I started working a program in my home. And it started getting better. I typed the traditions and I glued them on the icebox. And Saturday mornings were bad. Saturday mornings were bad for us. We had time on our hands. So I didn't know what to do with that. And so I'd run in and I'd call as soon as we'd all get up and start doing stuff. Keith was like, I used to say an alcoholic's like a blender. It's just whirling all the time. And he had so much nervous energy when he first got sober. And I'd go in and I'd get on the phone and I'd start talking to my sponsor. And, you know, Keith would come up to me and he'd be dressed you know, like a cowboy, and he'd kiss me, and he's going to a meeting. I'd say, okay, great, you know, bye, and I'd kiss him goodbye, and I'd talk to my sponsor, and then pretty soon here he'd come again, and he'd be dressed like a biker, and he'd say goodbye, and I'd say goodbye, and kiss him goodbye, and I was talking to my sponsor, and then pretty soon here he'd come again, and he'd be dressed up in a suit, and he'd say, bye, I'm going to a meeting, and I said, bye, and I'd kiss him goodbye, and pretty soon my sponsor says, how many people live in that house? And I said, oh, it's just Keaton Smart and I, but Keaton didn't know who he is today. He had had 3 or 4 identity crises before he could get to the meeting, you know. And that's the neat part about Al-Anon, is that you started teaching me the alcoholic personality. And I got where I started enjoying it. And he is so funny. He just cracks me up. We laugh all the time. I don't remember the last time we had an argument. And it used to be a daily thing in our home. That's a spiritual awakening. When did we fight? We were arguing the other day about a couple that we sponsored, and I said, when are we going to start fighting about ourselves? You know? it's funny. Keith and I work with a lot of young people. Yeah, we've had surrenders in this program, and it's the people in our home group. My home group is called Gotta Wanna Al-Anon Family Group, because you gotta want it to be in our group, because we're not half measures. We work the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where they came from, and we do that. We use the Al-Anon and AA 12 and 12 in our meeting. Because Bill Wilson in 1972 dedicated the 12 and 12 of AA to Al-Anon because we didn't have one yet. Al-Anon World Service Office will never tell you that, but there's still some living members of Al-Anon that was there to see it. I love this program. I love this way of life. I love my husband. He is so neat. I got to share with you one of the neatest things that happened this year. Keith and I have been going in the California Institute for Women in Chino, California, CIW, for 14 years. I first started going in there, people were asking me, what are you doing taking Al-Anon in there? And I'd say, because I know there's women in there just like me. And there are. You know, there's women in there just like me. And Keith came in this program a woman hater. And I think it was 6 months after I started my panel in there, AA gave him a panel in there. And so he's been going in there for 14 years. Neither one of us has missed a meeting in that prison in 14 years. And they were rowdy when we first started going in there. And they'd flip us off and cuss us out and all kinds of stuff. And I remember the first time I went in there and shared, and then this inmate got up afterwards, came up to me, and she said, I'm just like you. She said, I told my husband that's why I'm in here. She said, he sounds like he was just like your husband. And I said, were you drunk or loaded when you did what you did to get in here? And she said, no, as sober as I am standing here right now. She said, my husband was a drunk. And I stood in our living room, and I watched him shoot our daughter in the head with a 45, drunk. She said, but I got even. I showed him. I picked that gun up and I showed him. And she said, I'm in here doing a double life term because I couldn't prove that I didn't shoot my daughter too. And I stood there and I thought, but for the grace of God. And he started going in there and he started caring about women. He started understanding women in a prison. And this last year at Christmas, we went out there for their Christmas AA banquet. I'm the only Al-Anon that they've ever invited to their Christmas AA banquet. And those women mean so much to me. Two of my best friends are the Manson girls. They work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the wonderful members of AA in there. And Leslie thinks that she belongs in the program of Al-Anon because she did the things that she did to please a man, that she couldn't say no to him. And she shared her story with me. But this last Christmas, we went in there for the 14th time to their Christmas banquet. And we've taken turns doing entertainment in there. Got a Y Al-Anon group to do entertainment at the banquet one year, and next year be inmates, and this year was Keith's group to do entertainment. And they did a Tina Turner review for those inmates, and they loved it. And after the guys had done their entertainment, they said, Keith, we want you to come back up here. We have a surprise for you. And they set him down in front of everybody. And six lifers, six women that have killed men to get in there, said, we have something we want to give to you. And they started singing that song, Mr. Big Stuff. And they declared him Man of the Year at California Institute for Women. My God, it took 14 years of him going in a prison, sharing with women, for him to love women. Those women are so important to me. They have worked miracles in my life. Last week I was pissed off at work because I didn't get a raise like I thought I should. And I got to find out, you know, about not getting the raise like I thought I should on the same day that I was supposed to go to prison that night. Doesn't God work great? Because when I got out there in that prison Wednesday night, that raise just didn't seem to matter. It just wasn't any big deal. Because, you see, people have put in my life the things that really count. You know, it's like at Christmas, you know, the things that we get for this program, you can't find them under a tree wrapped in paper. It's a gift we get on a daily basis. And we do this thing one day at a time. And Keith shared with you last night about our daughter. And God, she's just the joy of our life. And she just, we love her so much. She accepted this program for herself. It's a way of life. And she's taken it everywhere with her. This last summer I got to go to Italy and share at a women's conference that she started over there. And they had a translator, Nadia, translated for me, a newcomer. And I got to go to different meetings. I was there for a week, and I got to go to different meetings, and Nadia would translate to me what they were saying to me. And then she got to translate to them what I was saying. Nadia heard more than anybody did in the whole week. And she's very special to me. And boy, you talk about language of the heart. We think that this thing is here, just right here. And there are people within miles of here dying, but it's all over the world. This disease goes everywhere, and it infects everybody, every place. Doesn't matter what sex, color, race, creed you are. It doesn't matter what language you speak. It is powerful. But you know what? I found out. So is the 12 steps. So is this program. So is the God of our own understanding. He put this world together. He gave this whole world recovery. You and I are just a small pebble. Just a small pebble in this tapestry of life. And to let you know how powerful God is. See, when I left over there this summer, I didn't think I'd ever see any of those people again, unless I went back. But in July, Al-Anon had its first world conference by itself in Salt Lake City, and about 100 people from our group went, AAs and Al-Anons. The AAs that have an Al-Anon in their life that they love went to that convention to support their loved ones program. And that kind of support just says a big, huge, I love you. The actions speak so loud, the words don't matter. And we got there, and there was those people from Italy there, along with everybody else, 22 countries represented. And Keith got to meet, they had two token Alfies with them. And Keith got to meet them. And they shared with us, and we're going to meetings, and Simone said, you know, they have the Italian rooms right over here. She said, I'd like to go on that meeting. I said, okay, I'm going to go to this meeting over here, and I'll meet you back there in a little bit. She said, okay. And so I went over at that meeting, and about 9 or 10 girls from my home group went in there with me. And we're sitting there, and there's 14 Italians in that room, and girls go in there with me. And so it ends up being about 30 people in that meeting, half my home group and half the Italian group. The guy leading the meeting, he hands a microphone just around the room, and everybody gets to share. And there was Simone and two other ladies in that meeting that could translate. So everybody that shared in there was translated into the language, the other language that they weren't speaking. At the very end, he hands Simone the microphone. And Simone said, never in my wildest dreams did I ever think that I could sit in one room and my home group for Italy and my home group from America be sharing in the same meeting. That's only a power that a God of our understanding could put together. And Sunday morning when it was all over, I got a picture of Keith and this Italian guy. The only three words they understood together was Alcoholics Anonymous, and they stood out in front of the Delta Center going, sober! It's powerful. We have a responsibility. There are so many people dying, and I don't want to be one that walks away and lets somebody die. I love working with the young people, and so does Keith, and I love him so much for working with others. I fall in love with him when I see him on another alcoholic's case. I fall in love with him when I see him embrace another alcoholic. Because, you see, it's not my husband's nature to love or to give anything away. And he's willing to give anything he has to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A dream, something that I dreamed of all my life. You see, if we don't have physical sobriety in our home, we have nothing. And at that prison Wednesday night, one of the inmates said, Sue, what would you do if Keith had a slip? And I said, oh my God. I don't know. I could only hope that I'd have a program. But I know that Keith, being as mean as he was when he got sober 22 years ago, the progression in the last 22 years, this is a deadly disease. I think before he really got started on a run, I'd have to kill him. It would be over. All of the stuff he gave us would be over. I don't ever want to go through this disease again. And you see, that's how I've learned that I can put my defects into assets in my life. I am stubborn. I am very stubborn. And by God, I'm not going to let this disease get me twice. And I pray to my God that everybody in here gets to have sober or emotional sobriety in their life as long as you choose to have it. A precious, precious gift that we can't wrap up and just give away in a package. We got to feel it, and we got to take the actions to make it happen ourselves. God helps those who help themselves. And God, I'm so grateful I had the want to when I got to you. You gave me a God. I heard about God through you. God uses people to help other people. And he used you, and he used inmates, he uses anybody to show me how my God works. And I want to close with a story that I only know that explains how my God is. And it's about a little boy that lived in the Texas or Oklahoma Panhandle. And he was laying in bed one night, and he was afraid because there was a thunder and lightning storm going on outside. And he ran in and got in bed with his mom and dad. And he's laying there shivering, and his daddy cuddled him up, and he goes, "Son, what's wrong with you?" And he said, "Oh, Daddy, I was afraid. I was afraid in there with the thunder and the lightning and everything, and I was in there by myself, and I was afraid." And his daddy cuddled him up, and he goes, "Oh, son," he said, "you didn't have to be afraid. You weren't in there alone. God was in there with you." And he looked up, and he said, "Oh, yeah, Daddy, I know that, but I need something with skin on it." And that's what you are to me. You're my God with skin on it. Thank you very much.